Welcome back to EVR 2858, the Endangered Species Act. In 1941, there were 15 whooping cranes left in the continental United States. The plight of the whooping crane was the driving force behind the initial efforts to pass the ESA, enacted in 1973. By the end of this lecture, you should be able to describe what an endangered species is, the ESA's three-pronged approach to species preservation, classify what a non-market species is and give an example, give one of the three rationales for species protection and give an example, determine what the God Committee is and its purpose, define the term critical habitat as defined in the ESA, the term take as defined in the ESA, and the term species of special concern under Florida law. Now, environmental law covers a lot of areas, but the underlying focus of the various laws tends to be protection of human health and welfare. Whether it is clean water for us to drink and swim in, to clean air for us to breathe, to regulating chemicals that can cause harm to us humans, the focus is mainly on human beings. There is one law, though, that looks to other living things, plants and animals, for the sake of plants and animals, the Endangered Species Act. So what was Congress thinking when they drafted this legislation? Let's take a look at their intent. So Section 2, Congressional Findings. All right, pause here and read it on your own, then start this back up again. All right, so you've just finished reading the Congressional Intent, Section 2. What does it say in English? Congress says some plants and animals have gone extinct because no one was looking out for them, and the United States has joined a bunch of international conventions to protect plants and animals in specific geographic areas, as well as supporting international efforts at species preservation. So what were some of the animals Congress was referring to? Well, we have the Mexican duck, the American alligator, the short-nosed sturgeon, the crested humming creeper, the California condor. How do we determine if a species is endangered or threatened? We look to the definition section of the law. So Section 3 of the ESA is all definitions. Section 3.6 says the term endangered species means any species which is in danger of extinction throughout all or a significant portion of its range, other than a species of the class Insecta, determined by the Secretary to constitute a pest whose protection under the provisions of this act would present an overwhelming and overriding risk to man. Threatened species, Section 3, subsection 20, is the term threatened species means any species which is likely to become an endangered species within the foreseeable future throughout all or a significant portion of its range. Now, why is the ESA such a controversial law? Well, it has a three-pronged approach to the problem of conserving species threatened with extinction. It closed down the United States' contribution to the worldwide market in endangered wildlife. It prohibits taking any endangered species, including heavy criminal sanctions. And Section 7 prohibits any federal action which could possibly harm an endangered or threatened species. Now, what do these prongs mean? Well, first, it provides a partial answer to the threats posed by the worldwide market in endangered wildlife by closing down the United States market. The free market fails to protect endangered species that have market value, such as leopards, turtles, rare birds for feathers, elephants for ivory, cactuses, and the like. Indeed, the market encourages the complete destruction of any endangered species that has market value by raising the value of each animal as it approaches extinction. As the market price per skin or rhino horn skyrockets, exploitation of the endangered species becomes almost impossible to stop. Either lesser developed countries of origin cannot afford to halt the lucrative trade, or high prices create poaching pressures that can subvert any local preservation efforts. The only way to prevent the elimination of a species was by shutting down the market in developed countries. The United States was a major market for such endangered species. To the extent that it has closed down that market, The ESA has eliminated the pressure on animals hunted to provide fur coats and other luxuries for the American fashion world's cosmopolitan tastes. Second, the Act's second strategy is a prohibition against taking any endangered species, a prohibition that attaches heavy criminal sanctions to the act of killing or capturing endangered animals. The taking provision, which generally does not apply to plants, was further strengthened by a definition that interprets take to mean harm, harass, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, kill, trap, capture, or collect, or to attempt to engage in any such conduct. As a result, protection is extended not only to exotic species, but to all endangered and threatened species within the jurisdiction of the United States. And then there is Section 7, which basically says the federal government could take no actions that would harm an endangered or threatened species or its habitat. Now, if you read through Section 7 quickly, it just says that agency has to talk with the Department of the Interior regarding preservation of endangered or threatened species. It is when you really read into Section 7 that you find the outright prohibitions of all federal actions that can harm an endangered or threatened species. Now, who administers the ESA? Well, you've got the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service under the Department of Interior. There's the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Defense, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Department of Commerce through the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the National Marine Fisheries Service. Now, it is important to note that all federal agencies are required to comply with the ESA. So Section 7 is interagency cooperation. It says that the Secretary of the Interior shall, he has no discretion here, has to do it, review other programs administered by him and utilize such programs in furtherance of the purposes of this act. All other federal agencies shall, in consultation with and with the assistance of the Secretary, and I'll let you pause here and finish reading it yourself. All right, now that we're back and you finished reading Section 7, note the words I've highlighted in bold here. Section 7 requires all federal agencies to consult with the Secretary of Interior to make sure that any and all federal actions do not jeopardize endangered or threatened species or destroy or adversely modify their habitats. And when looking at any federal action, the agency proposing the action has to use the best scientific and commercial data available. And if you look at the ESA and compare it to NEPA, they have similar language and similar focus of targeting actions of the federal government. While NEPA just requires procedural compliance to determine if an EIS is required or an EA is okay instead, the ESA contains a total substantive prohibition against all federal actions that impact on any endangered or threatened species, including the habitats of those species. Habitat destruction is the leading cause of extinction, more so than killing or hunting it. Why? Because many species are considered non-market species. So what is this phrase, non-market species? A non-market species lacks specific market value that is measurable. It often involves parts of various food chains and ecological webs that are disrupted. Examples occur when a desert becomes developed for irrigation farms, a prairie is destroyed for agribusiness, a swamp is drained to produce a parking lot. Here are some examples. The Fender's Blue Butterfly, unless you like collecting butterflies. The Kearney's Blue Star. The San Diego Fairy Shrimp, which are really, really small, and no, they're not really edible for humans. And the Florida Scrub Jay. Note, all these species have the potential to be disturbed, disrupted, or displaced because of human activities, i.e. development. And please note with the Florida Scrub Jay, I have been trying for years, I'm talking over 20 here, campers, to see this bird. I have heard it, but still haven't seen it to this day. It's one of the most annoying birds I've ever come across. Anywho, personal pet peeve, if you couldn't tell. Citizen suits. Yes, indeed, that is Big Bird and Snuffleupagus. So the question becomes, can the public play a role in protection of endangered species? Can Big Bird bring a lawsuit to have the government enforce the law or even prevent a private party from violating the law? So here we have Section 11. Pause here so you can read through this. All right. Now that you've read through this, note that it says any person. It doesn't mean that you have to be a citizen. So if you're somebody's visiting from another country and sees something, they're a person. But you have to sue on your own behalf. So after reading all this, the short answer is yes, Big Bird can sue if Big Bird were an actual real person. But why should we protect any species? This is where the rationale for endangered species protection comes into play. Why should we protect plants and animals that many people in the country will never encounter? No matter how hard you try to see the scrub jay, anywho, how many endangered plants and animals have you seen? Probably not many. And the ESA's prohibitions run headlong into direct opposition to the marketplace. This conflict between the ESA and the marketplace means the federal government must expend effort and money to ensure endangered and threatened species are not being brought into the U.S., and that not only government projects, but private projects as well, do not impinge on habitat for these species. But why do we put forth all this effort and money into preserving these species? There are three rationales. You have the utilitarian position. Preserving endangered species is in some way, directly or indirectly, important for the continued survival of human beings. An endangered species may possess chemical or medical properties that will never be discovered if the creatures are rendered extinct. We preserve species because of lessons they may teach us in the future. At some point, they may reveal a cure for cancer. This is the human-focused rationale. Next, there's the law of ecology. This is another argument, is that the more diversity that exists in the natural world, the more adaptable that world is to continuing stresses. This is Commoner's first rule of ecology we looked at with NEPA. Everything is connected to everything else. Barry Commoner, The Closing Circle. This argument reflects a fundamental law of ecology, that the more diverse a gene pool or ecosystem, the greater the natural bank of adaptive diversity upon which society can draw. All right, yes, I am a geek, I admit it, so it's Star Trek trivia time. Does anyone know the Star Trek terminology for this? It is the Vulcan philosophy known as IDIC, I-D-I-C, infinite diversity and infinite combinations. Yeah, I am indeed a sci-fi geek. Boldly go where no one has gone before. Then you have the quasi-religious argument. This is the argument for the sanctity of life. This is derived from a religious argument that humans were given the world to watch over, that humans are stewards of the natural environment around the globe and are only one part of the entire global community of living things. As we have seen with the specific wording of the ESA, it makes no distinction between species that have a commercial value or direct human utility and those that do not. This is why you read articles in the newspaper about some type of affected party upset that they are prevented from doing what they want because of some plant or snail they've never heard of. The statute gives legal value to an abstraction. The survival of species, insofar as possible, was declared a valid and important national goal. Now, keep in mind, I said it before and I will say it again, you do not have to subscribe to any one or all three of these rationales. I am just explaining what those rationales for species protection are. You can decide which one you prefer or if they all sound like bunk. All right, next, look at the Tellico Dam. This is one of the most famous ESA cases. It's the Tennessee Valley Authority versus Hiram Hill. This was a classic environmental conflict between a citizens group, including farmers, sportsmen, archaeologists, and the Cherokee Indians on one hand, And on the other was a group comprising a federal construction agency allied with private business interest, primarily real estate. The case started in the early 1960s and decided the fate of the last remaining undammed, and I don't mean, you know, dammed to hell kind of thing. I mean building a dam to block water, segment of the Little Tennessee River. The TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, made a compilation of all dammable sites in the Tennessee Valley system in 1936. The Teleco site was listed as a low priority because of its marginal cost justification. By 1960, more than 60 dams had been built by the TVA. The TVA repeatedly requested Congress to permit the Teleco Dam be built. In 1966, Congress finally passed an appropriations bill providing funds for the project. The TVA projected that the resulting reservoir would provide large recreation increases, although by this time, the Little Tennessee Valley was the last remaining stretch of high-quality recreational flowing river, with 24 other reservoirs within a 50-mile radius. At this time, more than 300 farm families lived in the valley. Hundreds of fishermen and canoeists loved it as the last best remaining stretch of clean flowing river in the region. And the valley of the Little Tennessee was sacred to the Cherokees, whose most revered places would be destroyed by a reservoir. The concrete part of the dam structure was built in 1968, but would not impound any part of the river until later. In 1970, NEPA gave the citizens group a new lease on life, and they filed suits to stop the project. Litigation under NEPA produced an injunction, which held for nearly 2 years, but ultimately was dissolved in 1973 when the TVA produced an adequate statement of the project's negative consequences. In the same year, Dr. David Eitner, a University of Tennessee ichthyologist, discovered a small endangered perch living in the midst of the Teleco Project area. It's the snail darter. And yeah, okay, I will maul the scientific name. Persina tenacis, tanisi, like I said, maul the Latin name. And a new round of litigation began under Section 7 of the ESA. The Teleco Dam Project would jeopardize the existence of endangered species and modify a critical habitat. No federal statutes permitted a straightforward challenge to the dam project, but the snail darter in Section 7 offered a handle to raise the challenge indirectly. The citizens groups filed administrative petitions in 1974, and court proceedings began in 1975. So, the TVA began working 3 shifts around the clock to moot the case before an injunction could issue. To win their case, the citizen groups had to back up their legal arguments with a rational benefit-cost alternatives accounting. The river was a major recreational resource on its own terms, even before it had been rendered a virtually unique resource by the impoundment of 2,500 linear miles of river in the surrounding region. The agricultural soils of the valley were of great economic value. The historic resources held great public value in their own right and could be capitalized monetarily in a tourist-based development if the valley's central portion was not flooded. And a major parcel of upriver project lands had particular potential for use as an access and overflow management area for the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. The citizens' benefit cost accounting thus included extensive consideration of development alternatives. In court, the citizens argued that the precarious existence of the endangered fish in the Little Tennessee constituted a barometer of endangered human and economic values in this last remaining stretch of high-quality river. The snail darter in the Little Tennessee was a canary in a coal mine. The trial court judge found the dam would destroy the snail darter, but refused to issue an injunction. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit reversed the trial judge, and the case went to the Supreme Court. Chief Justice Berger, writing for the court, stated, One would be hard-pressed to find a statutory provision whose terms were any plainer than those in Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act. Its very words affirmatively command all federal agencies to ensure that actions authorized, funded, or carried out by them do not jeopardize the continued existence of an endangered species or result in the destruction or modification of habitat of such species. This language admits no exception. Having determined that there is an irreconcilable conflict between operation of the Tellico Dam and the explicit provisions of Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act, we must now consider what remedy, if any, is appropriate. It is correct, of course, that a federal judge sitting as a chancellor is not mechanically obligated to grant an injunction for every violation of law. Congress has spoken in the plainest of words, making it abundantly clear that the balance has been struck in favor of affording endangered species the highest of priorities, hereby adopting a policy which it described as institutionalized caution. So the Supreme Court affirmed the Court of Appeals' issuance of the injunction. One thing to note about this case, and specifically the opinion, is the court never mentioned the plaintiff's evidence of environmental economic balancing or rational development alternatives, but looked solely to the prohibition in Section 7. The media portrayed this case as little fish bites dam, and cast the case and the plaintiffs as extreme environmentalism run amok. One of the arguments that the TVA advanced was retroactivity. The retroactivity argument urged that since the concrete part of the dam, worth $5 million of the $150 million total, had been built before the Endangered Species Act was passed, the project could continue even if it would eliminate the endangered species. The court upheld the citizens' argument that a statute should be applied if it prohibits actions that would cause, as in Justice Holmes' dictum, the evils that the legislature intended to address. Further, governmental agencies have no civil right or vested right to proceed with favorite projects in spite of subsequent federal legislation. The TVA argued that since Congress continued funding, there was an implied amendment to the ESA. The Supreme Court struck down that argument as well. There were many observers who called the result absurd or extreme. The Supreme Court held, however, that even when a statute led to what a court might think was an absurd result, if the facts fit the law, the statute was to be applied as it was written. In 1978, Congress amended the ESA to provide some flexibility. If you look back to the specific wording of Section 7 above, it mentions a committee. This is a cabinet-level review board dubbed the God Committee that could allow the extinction of a species. So look at the specific wording again in Section 7. It says the Secretary of the Interior shall review, and it goes on for all federal agencies, shall consult with the Secretary, and goes on to say, unless such agency has been granted an exemption by the committee pursuant to subsection H. So note, we have these two passages here, and they are complex enough that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service teaches an entire week-long course in just Section 7 consultations. So let's look at this in English again. The Secretary of the Interior is charged with making sure that not only the Department of the Interior, but all other federal agencies do not destroy an endangered or threatened species or critical habitat. Note, all federal agencies have the responsibility of complying with the ESA, even if it is an unfunded mandate for them. So what is this God Committee? The committee is established in Section 7E1 and is comprised of the Secretary of Agriculture, the Secretary of the Army, the Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, the Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, the Secretary of the Interior, the Administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and The president, after consideration of any recommendations received pursuant to subsection G2B, shall appoint one individual from each affected state as determined by the secretary to be a member of the committee for the consideration of the application for exemption for an agency action with respect to which such recommendations are made not later than 30 days after an application is submitted pursuant to this section. So, how do they make an exemption determination? Pause here, read the language, and then come back. All right, so what does this say in English? The GOD committee can allow a federal project to occur even if it violates Section 7 of the ESA if there are no other reasonable alternatives. The project benefits outweigh the species destruction. The project has regional or national significance. If the exemption is agreed to by at least 5 members of the committee, the agency must take mitigation measures to lessen the project's impact as much as reasonably possible. So back to the Tellico Dam case. The TVA permissioned the GOD committee for an exemption. The exemption was denied on January 23, 1979. The reservoir project, the committee said, deserved to be killed on its own merits. It must be noted that a rider was attached to a congressional appropriations bill explicitly overriding the Supreme Court decision and exempting the Tellico project from all federal and state protective laws and ordering the reservoir's immediate completion. Despite President Carter's threat of a veto, it was signed into law on October 4, 1979, and the reservoir was completed. Of the snail darter population that lived in the area prior to the reservoir's construction, none survived. Other smaller populations have been found in other sites. Then there's the northern spotted owl. And again, mauling, good old Latin. Strix occidentalis carina. Now, another high-profile case that many have heard about is the northern spotted owl. The Seattle Audubon Society filed suit for an injunction to prohibit the sale of logging rights in northern spotted owl habitat areas until the U.S. Forest Service complied with the National Forest Management Act by adopting standards and guidelines to assure that a viable population of the species was maintained in the forest. Right off the bat, who sees a problem with this argument? What is a viable population? The Forest Service regulations define viable population as one which has existing numbers and distribution of reproductive individuals to ensure its continued existence is well distributed in the planning area. Population biologists and ecologists have developed population viability analysis approaches to study this for a given species. To ensure population viability, habitat must be provided to support at least a minimum number of reproductive individuals. So, the Forest Service listed the spotted owl as a threatened species, but did not designate the critical habitat at the same time. And the United States District Court, Western District of Washington, slapped the service silly. Note, however, that critical habitat does not always have to be designated. A preliminary injunction was issued and a full hearing was held. So what is a critical habitat, you ask? This is under Section 5A in the definitions section, and it says, critical habitat means a specific area within the geographical area occupied by the species at the time it is listed, in accordance with the provisions of Section 4, on which are found those physical or biological features essential to the conservation of the species and which may require special management considerations or protections. And I'll let you finish reading the rest of it yourself. Okay, now that you've turned this back on, note, critical habitat does not have to be designated for each threatened or endangered species. Critical habitat can be designated through the use of just maps to mark out the space, or in combination with establishing primary constituent elements that characterize some specific attributes of the geographic area, making it a critical habitat. The Fish and Wildlife Service consultations on a threatened or endangered species and its critical habitat when it is designated are two separate consultations within one FWS biological opinion. This means that if the service could find no major concern with an endangered species for a proposed project, but there are impacts to its critical habitat, then there's a problem that will have to be fixed before the project moves forward. There is one thing I want you to note. Section 4A3B1 says, the secretary shall not, it's a ban, designate as critical habitat any lands or other geographical areas owned or controlled by the Department of Defense or designated for its use that are subject to an integrated natural resources management plan prepared under Section 101 of the Sykes Act. If the secretary determines in writing that such plan provides a benefit to the species for which critical habitat is proposed for designation. Does anyone remember the protesters at Vieques in Puerto Rico between 1999 and 2003? That wanted to stop the Navy from using it as a bombing range? Couldn't the protesters have used the ESA to stop the bombing? Well, no. This particular section stops that possibility cold. Now back to the loggers. The court found that the spotted owl lived in old growth forests. Most, if not all, old growth forests on private land had already been cut down, and all that remained was on public lands. The court further found the Forest Service had not followed the law or its own regulations. The court looked at all the facts presented and had to balance the equities. The loss of an additional 66,000 acres of spotted owl habitat without a conservation plan being in place and with no agency having committed itself to the Interagency Scientific Committee strategy would constitute irreparable harm and would risk pushing the species beyond a threshold from which it could not recover. Any reduction in federal timber sales will have adverse effects on some timber industry firms and their employees, and a suspension of owl habitat sales in the national forests is no exception. But while the loss of old growth is permanent, the economic effects of an injunction are temporary and can be minimized in many ways. The court issued the injunction and barred the logging. Another note. Since this lawsuit, scientists have kept up their study of the spotted owl and have noticed an increase in barred owls in the northern spotted owl habitat. Smithsonian Magazine published an article in January of 2009 about this intrusion, interviewing a forest biologist about the barred owl threat. Now, in 2012, the U.S. Geological Survey and Oregon State University published a study that reinforced the prior information about barred owls outcompeting northern spotted owls for habitat and resources. And yes, these links are live and still accessible. So why am I pointing to scientific studies if we are talking about the law? Because this one court decision in 1991... so we're talking over 30 years now, guys, prevented logging in the Mount Rainier National Park, Washington, established in 1899. A group of scientists from Oregon State University and Mount Rainier National Park used data collected between 1997 to 2016 to investigate how northern spotted owl occupancy dynamics and breeding propensity are related to the presence of barred owls, local and regional weather, and habitat characteristics at MRNP. The authors point out this study illustrates the strong relationship between barred owls and northern spotted owl demographics and breeding site selection in a landscape where habitat loss by timber harvest and fire has not occurred. The court decision allowed a pristine habitat to remain pristine and unaltered, creating a living laboratory. So we now know the ESA restricts the federal government. What about private citizens? Well, we have Section 9. And yeah, I'm a mom, so we have Sesame Street. Except as provided in Section 6G2 and 10 of this Act, with respect to any endangered species of fish or wildlife, note it doesn't say plants, listed pursuant to Section 4 of this Act, it is unlawful for any person subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, so within the jurisdiction of the United States. Finish reading this. Okay, we're back. In English, take a close look at this. This applies to you and me. Joe Public cannot import or export, take any listed species within the U.S. or U.S. waters, on the high sea, which is outside U.S. jurisdiction, possess, sell, deliver, carry, transport, or ship any listed species. Deliver, receive, carry, transport, or ship in interstate or foreign commerce from the United States or to the United States any listed species. Sell or offer for sale any listed species or violate any ESA regulation. So, if an alligator decides to move into the pool in your backyard and threatens you or a member of your family with bodily harm, you cannot shoot it to death to protect yourself. You would be under arrest for violating the ESA. If the alligator were a human being, then under criminal law, you could shoot the human and you would fall into an exception known as self-defense. A bit twisted if you think about it. I guess that's why we have animal control and not human control. Yeah, bad pun, but I'm a lawyer and a New Yorker, so it goes hand in hand. Section 9A2 says the same thing, but applies strictly to plants. Having said all that, there is the possibility of a private landowner petitioning for an incidental take permit from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service under the 1982 amendments. This permit allows a non-federal landowner to proceed with an activity that is legal in all other respects, but that results in the incidental taking of a listed species. The ESA defines incidental take as take that is incidental to and not the purpose of the carrying out of an otherwise lawful activity. Now, you may have heard recently there's a story in the news about a Connecticut couple who found a black bear sleeping under their back porch, and they've decided they're going to be nice and let it, you know, stay there for the winter. Same concept. So Section 9 hit the courts hard in Babbitt versus Sweet Home Chapter of Communities for Great Oregon. A group of small landowners, logging companies, and families dependent on the forest products industries in the Pacific Northwest and in the Southeast, and organizations that represent their interests, filed suit challenging the ESA regulations promulgated by the Secretary of the Interior and the Director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So we're looking at take here. Congress defined the term take to mean harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, kill, trap, capture, or collect, or to attempt to engage in any such conduct. The Secretary of the Interior further defined harm to include significant habitat modification or degradation where it actually kills or injures wildlife. Note, this definition is no longer part of the Fish and Wildlife Service's regulations governing ESA. Also note, take applies to individual species, but not to designated critical habitat. Now, Sweet Home Chapter of Communities for a Great Oregon, the respondents, filed suit in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia, challenging the regulation on its face. Their complaint alleged that application of the harm regulation to the red-cockaded woodpecker, an endangered species, and the northern spotted owl, a threatened species, had injured them economically. Remember from my introduction lecture that the plaintiffs had to show standing and that they suffered an injury. The trial court granted summary judgment for the secretary. Note here, summary judgment means that the court took a look at the pleadings and said there is no conflict, case dismissed in favor of the defendants. The plaintiffs appealed to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. A panel of three judges affirmed the judgment of the district court. The Sweeney Home Chapter petitioned for a rehearing before the entire court, known as en banc, which was granted. This time, the Court of Appeals reversed the district court. I want to point out that the Supreme Court's jurisdiction is limited. We're talking the U.S. Supreme Court. A case does not get to the U.S. Supremes until there is a real conflict of law. The Supreme Court doesn't look at facts. They aren't into the minutiae. They look at legal concepts. In this case, the Supreme Court found a conflict between this decision of the District of Columbia Circuit and a 1988 decision of the Ninth Circuit, which upheld the Secretary's definition of take. The Supreme Court noted that Congress had crafted the ESA to give the Secretary broad discretion in administering the law. The court therefore upheld the Secretary's definition of harm and reversed the Court of Appeals' judgment. Current issues with the ESA. The ESA is only applied to a single species at a time. There is no ecosystem-based approach, nor is there any attempt to create a multi-species listing process. We have listing versus delisting of species. Listing takes a lot of time. The ultimate goal is to not have any species that need to be listed. Since 1973, a total of 99 species have been delisted. The most recent was the snail darter, which was categorized as recovered in November 2022. Delisting information can be found at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Environmental Conservation Online Service, ECOS, at the link here. In 2007, the bald eagle was delisted, but it is still protected by the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So, to attempt to delist or not? Well, no explicit criteria for deciding when a species should be listed, delisted, or downlisted exist. And no management agency has come up with a rigorous and objective definition for when a species can be considered recovered. Now, in the summer of 2022, the USFWS added the migratory monarch butterfly to the endangered list. In November 2022, the USFWS reclassified the northern long-eared bat from threatened to endangered. And in December, the white bark pine was listed as threatened. USFWS's endangered species website is here at this link. In fall 2021, the USFWS proposed to delist 23 additional species, all due to extinction. Well, what about Florida? Well, Florida statute section 372.072 from 2004, Endangered and Threatened Species Act. The legislature recognizes that the state of Florida harbors a wide diversity of fish and wildlife, and that it is the policy of this state to conserve and wisely manage these resources, with particular attention to those species defined by the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, the Department of Environmental Protection, or the United States Department of the Interior or successor agencies as being endangered or threatened. As Florida has more endangered and threatened species than any other continental state, it is the intent of the legislature to provide for research and management to conserve and protect these species as a natural resource. So Florida says, hey, we have a whole slew of these guys. We think it's a good thing to protect them. So the Florida endangered species, any list of fish and wildlife naturally occurring in Florida, whose prospects of survival are in jeopardy due to modification or loss of habitat, overutilization for commercial, sporting, scientific, or educational purposes, disease, predation, inadequacy of regulatory mechanisms, or other natural or man-made factors affecting its continued existence. So what are we talking about here? Well, we have a wood stork, and we have the Florida panther, of course. Florida threatened species is any species of fish and wildlife naturally occurring in Florida, which may not be in immediate danger of extinction, but which exist in such small populations as to become endangered if it is subject to increased stress as a result of further modification of its environment. So we have the Florida black bear and the bald eagle. An interesting facet of Florida law is that it has not only the categories of endangered and threatened species, but it also lists species of special concern. If you've read the Florida law, it makes no mention of the categories of species of special concern. One must look at the Florida Wildlife Conservation Commission regulations to come up with that definition. So, a species of special concern is one that fits into one or more of the following categories: has significant vulnerability to habitat modification, environmental alteration, human disturbance, or human exploitation, which, in the foreseeable future, may result in its becoming a threatened species unless appropriate protective or management techniques are initiated or maintained. May already meet certain criteria for designation as a threatened species, but for which conclusive data are limited or lacking. May occupy such an unusually vital or essential ecological niche that, should it decline significantly in numbers or distribution, other species would be adversely affected to a significant degree. Has not sufficiently recovered from past population depletion, and occurs as a population either intentionally introduced or being experimentally managed to maintain specific objectives, and the species of special concern prohibitions in Rule 68A-27.002-FAC. Shall not apply to species so designated, provided that the intentional killing, attempting to kill, possession, or sale of such species is prohibited. So this is a regulation as opposed to an outright statute. We've got the alligator and the roseate spoonbill here. Now, Florida is home to tropical and subtropical plant and animal species. This massive biodiversity draws many people to Florida. As the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission puts it, Florida's natural lands and waters are at the core of our state's prosperity, bringing billions of dollars in economic benefits to our state every year. Our forests, rivers, and creeks and coastal waters are invaluable to fish and wildlife and to our own quality of life. Note that this statement is focused on human quality of life and economic impact. The interesting thing is that the FWC goes on, but recent predictions indicate that our state's human population may double to 36 million in the next 50 years. If that happens, as a study published by 1,000 Friends of Florida suggests, about 7 million acres of land could be converted from rural and natural to urban uses. If we develop as we have in the past, roads, shopping malls, and subdivisions will replace the rich diversity our landscape currently offers. Development will also impact our coastal waters and coral reefs. So the FWC created a report to look at various possibilities and how and what we Floridians can do to preserve our environment so we do not lose the biodiversity and wild places we have in the state. The report is Florida 2060 at the given link. So what about endangered species in the news over the last few years? Well, we've got the Florida panther. In May 2019, Governor Ron DeSantis signed legislation called MCORS, the Multi-Use Corridors of Regional Economic Significance Program, into law that will build three toll roads across the state. These corridors include two in northwestern Florida, one that would include the extension of the Florida Turnpike, and another called the Suncoast Connector, which would build a new corridor 150 miles long from Citrus County all the way to the Georgia state line. The third highway would span 140 miles from Orlando to Naples, though the exact route has yet to be determined, even to this day. Regardless of the alignment, however, it would slice through some of the state's wildest remaining lands and vital territory for the panther, the state's official animal. All three roads could potentially impact the wildlife corridor in some way, as stated by National Geographic. In 2022, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission recorded one new litter and 25 panther deaths, mostly by vehicle strike. They also track depredation events when a panther attacks other animals, and there were four events in 2022. Atlantic corals. The Florida Aquarium has teamed up with London's Horniman Museum and Gardens on Project Coral, an effort to induce spawning in a laboratory. That sounds simple, but the task of artificially replicating the annual conditions that cause corals to spawn in the wild is exceedingly complex. In 2014, the Florida Aquarium became the first institution to raise staghorn coral larvae in the library. The endangered Florida Reef Tract, which runs off the coast of Florida from Martin County to the Dry Tortugas, desperately needs such assistance. The reef tract has already lost more than 90% of its staghorn and elkhorn corals. Pollution, disease, climate change, and boat damage are factors. So, whooping cranes. The picture I used to introduce this segment is of a whooping crane. The whooping crane, Gris americana, the tallest North American bird, is an endangered crane species named for its whooping sound. Along with the sandhill crane, it is one of only two crane species found in North America. Thanks to intense conservation efforts, the population has grown from a low of 21 to 22 individuals in 1941 to 802 captive and wild individuals in 2021, with around 136 in captivity. And that's from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Our next lecture will be part one of the Clean Water Act.